he certainly did take a conservative position on many issues. But his statement that if they could have refuted it, they would, doesn't carry any weight to a historian. It first of all assumes that anybody cared. By the end of the first century, how big was Christianity? I don't think anyone can give us an estimate of the numbers. It had been mentioned, I think, in about two, possibly three writers by this time. It was regarded as another one of the many religious sects, groups, cults that were around in Rome. They were ubiquitous. Why would anyone even bother to refute something they regarded as laughable anyway? So to say that if they could have refuted it, they would, doesn't carry very much weight. Now we come to the question of the empty tomb, the missing body. In order to argue that, you have to take the Gospels at face value. And again, I come back to the fact that these are late documents. 1 Corinthians 15, Paul does not say anything about an empty tomb. He says about the appearance of Jesus. He doesn't mention the empty tomb. Some have said he implies it. I don't think that's a necessary interpretation. He certainly makes no issue of it. And the question is whether he would have to presuppose it in order to talk about or to think about the resurrection. And how much time have I got?
2 minutes.
I just refer you here at this point to a book from Jewish Prophet to Gentile God by Morris Casey, the Cadbury Lectures at Birmingham in 1987 or 8. He gives a rather interesting explanation of how the tradition developed. In Jewish apocalyptic literature, the vindication of the righteous martyr was extremely important. However, this vindication was demonstrated by their going immediately to their reward. Now, how would you know they had gone to their reward and therefore that they had been vindicated? Well, the normal way was by their appearing in a dream or a vision, or perhaps by defending it through the use of Scripture, which was seen as, of course, being divine. So the important thing, as Casey argues, is the manifestation, and therefore Jesus' manifestation was the important thing. The empty tomb wouldn't have been necessary because, of course, the martyrs who had died were expected to have been in their tombs. Thus, the early disciples would have seen Jesus' manifestations in a dream or a vision as the important issue, not the question of the empty tomb, which would explain why the empty tomb comes along in later sources. Now, it's a point of view. It's a point that could be argued. But what my point is that the empty tomb is not a foregone conclusion. And it's only when you take the Gospels at face value, and that is not a presupposition that I think a historian can make.
And please, Professor Montgomery, for his rebuttal.
Yes, I'll take these several points in order because it'll be easier to relate them to what Professor Graba has just said. He's mentioned several times that there is no evidence, for example, from the Romans or from the Jews. We have only the evidence that comes within the New Testament. I shouldn't have to remind him that the people in the New Testament were either Romans or Jews. That is to say, Paul was a Roman citizen, and all of the people who are described there, other than Paul and a few others, were in fact of the Jewish community. You see, what we have here is a situation in which those people say, we weren't believers, but as a result of Jesus rising from the dead, we became believers. Professor Graba takes the view, well, after all, they're believers, so we can't pay much attention to what they're actually saying. This is highly illogical. The fact of the matter is that they were brought into a state of belief, according to them at least, by the evidence. And, you know, there's a gigantic difference between scholarly opinion at the present time and what those documents are saying. The documents at least claim to represent personal contact with Jesus or contact with those who had contact with Jesus. Whereas, 2,000 years later, various opinions are given on the matter as to what actually was the situation. It would seem to me that a historian ought to place primary emphasis on what the writers are saying themselves. All right. Secondly, there's the matter of other religions. Professor Grabe has made this point in a couple of his writings, that if one takes a sympathetic view of the resurrection or the miracles in the Bible, then why doesn't one take that same sympathetic view of miracles or similar religious claims as they appear elsewhere? He, in fact, implies that those fundamentalists that he can't stand simply rule out the latter while accepting the former dogmatically. Well, it just might be that this is an open universe in which all such claims deserve careful investigation. I happen to believe that. I did a book on the occult, as I mentioned, and I did some serious investigation into occult claims, just as the Society for Psychical Research does here in England. Now, we don't know ahead of time whether a given peculiar event is veridical or not, but it deserves investigation. Why is it, for example, that I don't go along with Muhammad's night journey? Well, because I happen to have read the Quranic material and I've read the Muslim commentaries on it. Here we have Al-Sharawi's Miracles of the Quran, and we are told that Muhammad was the only human to be carried by night upon the heavenly horse from the sacred mosque in Mecca to the farthest mosque in Jerusalem. No one except Muhammad saw it being performed. In other words, there is absolutely no corroboration to this, and indeed, that's a late tradition in itself. But if the evidence were better, I couldn't rule it out. How about the Mormons? Well, Professor Grabe hasn't told you that in the original list of those who confirmed Joseph Smith's statements, there was included a Professor Charles Anthon of King's College, now Columbia University. And when the book came out with a list of testimonies, Anthon paid for an advertisement in what would later be the New York Times, in which he said, "I never knew Joseph Smith, and with good luck, I never will." In other words, a testimony had been included which was absolutely fallacious. And that left a couple of farmers whose testimonies were questionable anyway. The fact of the matter is that the plates of the angel Moroni were taken back into heaven, so we have a perfect case of unverifiability. If the evidence were better, though, I would certainly have to take it seriously. Look at Walter Martin's work, The Maze of Mormonism, or look at the works of people who have departed from Mormonism in the last few years. It's been discovered, for example, that this stuff was not in old Egyptian by any stretch of the imagination. Now, we could go on with other illustrations, but my view of the universe happens to be an open one. I think it's the Einsteinian approach that we have to look at these things seriously, and we cannot prejudice the situation by looking at strange events as more difficult to deal with than other events. The criteria are going to be the same. On the matter of inerrancy, this may surprise you, Professor Grabe, but I happen to believe that the Bible is inerrant in the autographs. I happen to believe that's why I am a fundamentalist in your terms, but I come to that conclusion because if Jesus rose again from the dead, then he's God Almighty, and if he's God Almighty, he knows more about the Bible than I'll ever know, and he regarded it as completely authoritative. Therefore, on the basis of inductive, empirical evidence, I arrive at the conclusion that the Bible is of that sort. I don't take it as a dogmatic assumption, I reach it as a conclusion. And that's true of the people that you vilify, such as Edwin Yamauchi, who doesn't deserve the kind of review you did of his book. Called him on the phone, as a matter of fact, before this debate to talk with him about the whole thing. All right. At peak hours across the Atlantic. What about Paul? Why does Professor Grabe say that Paul could well have created this experience himself instead of actually having it as Paul says? I mean, shouldn't we take what Paul says about his own experience as primary? Why should we engage in a reductionism, a kind of psychological reductionism? The fact of the matter is that we've got to be more serious in using our historical materials. We can't just play fast and loose with them. Some of the examples given, I thought, were were really questionable. Professor Graba says, I could write a novel here in Hull, and I could give a lot of specific historical detail. But if Professor Graba were to say in that work that he was in fact presenting history, and it turned out later that he wasn't doing that, then of course there would be a very large moral question mark placed over what he does. In the case of the New Testament writers, for example, Luke, they do everything they possibly can to make clear that they are writing history. They're saying, we're not doing fable. We know what fable is. We're not doing that. But Professor Graba says, well, of course, they can say that, but they don't necessarily do what they say they're doing. You know, this comes out to technical meaninglessness. What could possibly count against such an argument? The more a person says, I'm not writing a novel, the more the person says, I'm writing history, the more you say, well, he still could be tricking us, or he could still be using a clever literary style. In order to keep ourselves from going mad, most of us have to take the intention of writers as the writers set it forth. We may occasionally be deceived by this, but we can't drop down the rabbit hole like Alice and begin to think that no one is actually doing what he says he's doing. As far as the dating is concerned, I'm sorry to tell you that the consensus of contemporary scholarship is not what Professor Graba says. It is not such that the New Testament materials are placed after 90 or at the end of the first century. The fact is, there has been a steady movement in this century toward earlier and earlier dating. The most distinguished American biblical archaeologist of his generation was William Foxwell Albright. Albright was not a clergyman, he had no theological axe to grind, and shortly before his death, Albright said, in my judgment, every book of the New Testament was written by a baptized Jew before 70 AD. Before 70, before the fall of Jerusalem. Now, that's undoubtedly an exaggeration. John's gospel undoubtedly came after that. We know this for various reasons, but it was still written by a person who had immediate contact with the events. But this is typical of the movement of scholarship today. Professor Graba is relying upon older and less adequate material when he tells you this. And the reason that the people date the stuff that late is largely the rationalistic assumption that because the fall of Jerusalem is described in those gospel records, it must have been written after the event and put back as a prophecy which never actually was made. And yet none of us knows that prophecy of that kind is impossible. The writers say that that was a prediction of Jesus himself. And of course, if he rose again from the dead, I suppose he wouldn't have had a great deal of difficulty predicting the fall of Jerusalem. Even John J.A.T. Honest to God Robinson, you know, the Bishop of Woolwich in the 1960s, the radical, even Robinson, by the time he wrote his last book, made exactly the same statement as Albright, that all of this stuff precedes the fall of Jerusalem. And he even argued for Matthean priority, for the priority of the book of Matthew, which is not necessarily the case, but it's another indication of the fact that the documents are moving back, and they're moving back in time simply because of the overwhelming evidence in this regard, such as the evidence from the date of the death of Paul, book of Acts, as I've indicated, and the material that is given collaterally by Papias and by Polycarp at the beginning of the second century connects directly with the generation of the apostles themselves. Classical historians would sell their grandmothers for that kind of corroborating evidence when it comes to other materials of the classical world. As a matter of fact, some years ago at the University of British Columbia, I was in discussion with a professor of philosophy by the name of Strowell, and Strowell said that as far as he was concerned, there probably never was a person called Jesus at all. So we went through all this evidence, and my whole point was that the same techniques that are used to establish the value of classical sources will do a better job on the New Testament sources. I said, if you don't go along with this, you're going to have to give up your knowledge of the classical world. This was on a public occasion. And Stroll said, "All right," he said, "I'll give up my knowledge of the classical world." At which point, the head of the classics department jumped up and said, "Good Lord, Abram, not that! You can't simply dump your knowledge of classical antiquity because these materials are uncomfortable. Did no one care about Christianity in the first century? Well, the Jews cared enough about it to crucify Jesus. I think that probably indicates that there was a great deal of concern about this particular offshoot of Judaism. If there was that much concern, doesn't it seem strange that afterwards, when these writings are in circulation claiming that he rose again from the dead, nothing is said about it. Nothing is said to try to refute it at all. Oh, there are statements, strange statements made, no doubt about that, but the statements very definitely are not an attempt to show that this didn't occur. All right, it seems to me that we have to ask ourselves, what would really count against the New Testament writers doing exactly what they say they're doing? I think if you're in doubt in a situation like this, you ought to go along with what they claim to be doing, not engaging in some kind of psychoanalysis of motives that they might have or things they might have done. They certainly tell you that they are not novelists. If you want to make them into novelists, you've got to impose that on them. They're not telling you that they're doing that at all.
If the professors, their breath, could both make their way to the podiums, that would be very, very helpful. Okay, are there any questions that we have? Gentlemen, if you could go, please. Thank you very much indeed. I did say just your breath. Okay. Sir, on the front, could you stand, please? Okay, question is, I'd like to ask both gentlemen, and perhaps Professor Graeber, you could go first, as to whether they see Jesus as mad, bad, or God.
Sounds like a Sergio Leone film title, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I could answer that with a yes.
You certainly... you certainly are a theologian.
Professor Graeber, thank you.
Do you really not want to say anything more about that? If you don't, I'm upset.
I'm not sure how relevant the third point is. Do I regard Jesus as God? I think that's a statement of personal belief, which I have at this point declined to comment on. Mad, I don't think we have enough evidence. Bad, all of the tradition makes him good. So obviously we couldn't say it's bad.
We need Professor Montgomery to answer, if we can.
Well, if of course he made these gigantic claims and they are untrue and he knew what he was doing, then he was morally bad. If he made these claims and they aren't true and he didn't know what he was doing, then he was mad, right? That's autism, right? It's a lack of contact with reality, knowing who one really is. Albert Schweitzer, in his medical dissertation, when he took his third doctorate at the University of Strasbourg, it was in medicine, and his thesis was on a psychiatric examination of Jesus. And there, Schweitzer tried to show that Jesus could have believed that he was the Son of God coming on the clouds of heaven at the end of time to wrap up history, and yet it not be so, and yet Jesus could be perfectly sane. And the preface to the English translation of this is done by Wilfred Overholtzer, who was then the president of the American Psychiatric Association. And Overholtzer says, "I'm not entirely convinced, because often in psychiatric wards, I've met people who have ideas like this." And that, of course, reminds one of the story of the fellow who went into the psychiatric ward and saw the gentleman with his hand like this. He was wearing a tricorn. And the fellow said, "Who are you?" And the fellow said, "Napoleon is here." And the fellow said, "Well, what makes you think that?" Said, "God told me." And a voice from the other side of the room, "I did not."
Okay, thank you. Thank you for your answers to the questions. And thank you for the joke. Okay. Can we have another question, please? Another question. Yes, please stand up. Nice and clear. Professor Gravy, if you don't believe in a resurrected Jesus...
Well, as I said at the beginning, I may or may not believe in a resurrected Jesus.
Oh, don't be cagey.
The question of what happened to the missing body, but this is a historical examination. The question of what happened to the missing body, again, I have to say, you're talking about the Gospels and the story that they tell about a missing body. This is a later tradition. It is not mentioned by the earliest tradition. So the question would be, how did that come about? But you're asking where the body went, and I'd have to say I don't know that the body was missing. The question of where the tradition came about, I think there are several explanations for that. One is that perhaps it became an embarrassment at some point, and you have to explain it. But I think that the difficulty of getting back to what is the core, the historical core of that, is extremely difficult. This is what I've said. There have been a lot of learned monographs on the subject, and generally they don't agree because it is very difficult material. Just to remind you what I said, Mark, the earliest one to refer to the tomb being empty, is writing, as I say, this is not my dating, this is a general consensus of scholarship. That is one of the more stronger consensus. Other things, there's less. He is writing after approximately 40 years of Christian interpretation, reinterpretation, expressions of faith. He himself has his own agenda. And it's very difficult to try to penetrate that to find out what the actual situation was, what was the earliest belief or the earliest tradition about the tomb.
Thank you. Have another question? Yes, sir. Stand up, please, and address the question. Thank you. And here's a question too, sir. Okay, question is, I presume it's to Professor Montgomery, if you believe that Jesus was the Son of God, who was the wife of God?
Yeah. If you believe that the Iraq War was the mother of all battles, who was the father of all battles? I'm not being facetious. You're assuming that when I use that expression, or when the expression is used in the New Testament, it's being used biologically. God had two problems in getting married. First, there wasn't any female available. Secondly, who would have performed the ceremony?
We need to move to another question. Have you finished answering that one, Professor? Okay, thank you. Thank you. Do we have another question, please? Yes, sir, over here. Stand up, please. Okay, the question is, because the documents are obviously such a key part of this particular discussion, will Professor Montgomery comment on the theological development that took place between the alleged resurrection and the recording of those New Testament documents?
A generation ago, people were very confident in the New Testament field that they could construct a development along the lines of what you're suggesting, from the original events on to the developed description of them as we have them in the resultant Gospels. And they attempted to do this by identifying particular communities, belief communities within the early church, and these belief communities were supposed to have shaped the original material concerning Jesus to fit their particular presuppositions. This has almost totally fallen in, and the reason for this is that we have only the resultant documents. In other words, everything is speculative as to the effect that those religious communities may have had. And I was fascinated to see that even Professor Graba agrees with this. In this TypeScript thing of yours on prophets, sages, and stuff like that there, I believe it's a student handout, I'm not sure, but in the introduction to that, you make the point that you can't rely on that kind of approach, the sort of a form-critical approach, in order to get satisfactory results, and that it really is necessary to deal with the resultant texts rather than trying to do such a reconstruction.
Well, you're this is actually a book now, which is in the press.
Who publishes it, Professor?
And what's the price?
Yeah.
Trinity Press International. That's a long, long story I could comment on. Actually, it doesn't go quite the way you seem to think it does.
I have the pages right over here, all underscored.
I can explain what I said.
Right.
What I pointed out was that the confidence with which people sorted out the traditions by form criticism, that is starting to be eroded. This doesn't mean all form critics have given up the idea by any means. I was referring, of course, specifically to the Old Testament. The New Testament is a separate discipline, and the same things don't necessarily happen. But the point I was making was that, therefore, the idea that we can sort out early from late is a difficult problem. Now, I didn't, therefore, conclude, therefore, it must be all early, and therefore, the Pentateuch must have been written by Moses. This is not at all what I said. What I say is that I'll start with the final form, interpret the material there, and then from there I try to attempt the question of whether we can say anything about the society from the literature. I recognize a problem which we have with the Gospels, and that is, in the Old Testament and with the Gospels, all we have is literature. We do not have a society. We have literature, and we try to use that to get back to historical events, to a society, to happenings, and so on. But the gap between those two is a strong one. And the question is whether we can bridge it. This is the problem that I was wrestling with. I didn't start with the assumption that, well, because we can't sort it out form critically, therefore it all goes back early. On the contrary, it simply shows the problem means that it's intractable in many cases. And with the Gospels, this is what I say. We can't sort it out.
Okay, thank you. We have time for a couple more questions. We come back. One right at the back, sir, if you could stand and address us, please. I guess we'll leave that to debate later on. Thank you.
You don't know what you did yesterday?
Okay, let me just repeat the question. We just want a question rather than a dissertation, please, if that's possible.
I'm never going to call you as a witness.
Yeah. I'll allow me to just try and elucidate the question if I can. Otherwise, we could be here. Thank you. Thank you very much. They say lawyers are expensive. The question is, if one asserts the oneness of God, do we then at the same time, by claiming a resurrection of the Son of God, recognize a divisibility in God? Professor McMontgomery, I think he's asking you.
I'm sure he must be, yes. Yes. The picture that we have of God has to be built up inductively by discovering from him who he's like. It's a tremendous mistake to start out with some kind of a preconceived, a prioristic view of God and then take that to a particular problem and say, well, the problem doesn't seem to fit it. What we know about God will come about if we have a sound revelation from him as to who he's like. So what Christianity has done is to build up a picture of God from Jesus' own teaching. And Jesus tells us that God is tripersonal. That, of course, gets into the whole matter of the Trinity. We're not going to get into that now. But if you'd like an analogy for this, I will give you one. In the area of physics, we can subject light to two perfectly valid series of experiments, and we will find that light is corpuscular and it is undulatory. It's wave and particle. We don't know how those relate to each other, but we can't shove one of them under the rug and maintain the other. We can't create two denominations, the wavists versus the particleists, and start writing tracts and booklets against each other. What we have to do is to take all the empirical data into account, and so we invent the term photon, to cover that phenomenon that we don't understand, which is backed up by the empirical data. Now, the church uses the term Trinity functionally as the physicist uses the term photon. We don't know how the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit relate to each other, but we have clear, solid evidence from Jesus himself that that's the nature of God. So, as Luther said, we take off our hat, bow, and go our way.
One last question. Mm-hmm. The gentleman up here. Will you stand and please address your question? Okay. Try and put that question together. Given Christians for 1600 years believed that the sun rolled around the earth, can Christians be trusted to give any scientific or factual evidence on this particular issue, and is fact stranger than fiction? You're addressing Professor Montgomery. Mr. Gray, would you like to comment on that?
Yes, I would say that Christians have been a part of the society in which they lived and represented, in most cases, the prejudices and outlook and worldview in that society. That doesn't mean that there couldn't have been some bucking of that. I mean, individuals can think for themselves. But this is the whole reason that I approach the New Testament material as I do any other material. I see it as the product of human beings. And by the way, the statement has been made that Jesus made certain claims. I have to remind everyone, Jesus, so far as we know, didn't write a word. What we have are claims made by others about what he said, and therefore we have already a distance between him and us. And therefore, we have to evaluate these things, though, in their context. And so, yes, the Ptolemaic view of the universe was widely accepted as far as people who thought about that far went. So we have to take that into account when we're interpreting the evidence, and this is what historians do routinely.
Yes, I think we have to distinguish between scientific theories or scientific conclusions and historical descriptions. That is to say, before we had the benefit of modern astronomical data and the like, when we read the book of Genesis, there seemed to be no reason in the world why it shouldn't describe a 7-day, 24-hour, or 6-day, 24-hour creation, right? Later on, when we do scientific investigation and we discover various things that would lead to some other conclusion, then we go back and we look at the data from that standpoint, and what do we discover? We discover, for example, that the Hebrew word yom for day can mean in the Old Testament an unlimited period of time. A day is with the Lord, a yom is with the Lord is 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is a day. And therefore, we have another context or gestalt by which we can understand those data. The fact that our understanding of scientific matters of that kind changes certainly doesn't impugn the ability of people to tell whether somebody is alive or dead. And therefore, the historical question of the resurrection of Jesus Christ can't be shoved off as simply a question parallel to the days of the earth.
Thank you very much. Does that mean that Jesus was in the tomb 3 unlimited periods of time?
Well, it certainly could mean that if A, we had a Hebrew text, which we don't, or an Aramaic text, or B, if it wasn't made clear from the very historical data that he was dashing around during the subsequent 40 days and was observed to do the things we've already mentioned.
Thank you very much. Professor Montgomery? Professor Graeber, if you could stay, and if you're ready at this point, just to give him a moment to collect his thoughts. What two speakers are going to do now is make their final 7-minute conclusory comments, and then after that, I'm going to ask you to consider amongst yourselves what you perceive, if your thinking has changed in any way at all, or on the evidence that has been presented this evening, the nature of the decision that you would make. And that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Just a reminder of what we were trying to do. We were asking whether an ordinary historian, who was not necessarily a Christian, would feel that the historical evidence was convincing enough to say that the resurrection probably happened. I do not have to disprove the resurrection. If it has not been proved, then the argument has been lost. To prove the resurrection, one would need several things. Resurrection is not a common experience. To establish it, one needs to show that other more normal explanations must be ruled out. Ideally, one would like to have a variety of independent eyewitnesses of integrity and soundness of mind, i.e. people of different background, ideology, perspective, whose testimony could seem to be complementary and not contradictory. The comment was made that all of the New Testament writers were Romans and Jews. That obviously is not the point I was making. The point is that they did have an interest in believing in the resurrection, and therefore their accounts could be influenced by that. So when I emphasize independent eyewitnesses, I could mean people who did not, at the end of the day, believe in the resurrection or Jesus, and who nevertheless testified to it. This is what we would like to have. In addition, one would like to have some artifactual evidence, some archaeological remains that would demonstrate the fact. That would be difficult to find, but perhaps one could think of something. In any case, it's clear that we don't have these ideal requirements. Therefore, I wish to summarize the situation that is present before us in 5 points. One is, we have no claims of any sort to have seen the actual event. No one claims to be an eyewitness to the resurrection. Two, the most significant evidence we have are claims to have experienced the risen Jesus. However, this evidence itself is quite thin. Only one of the reports is an eyewitness account, and that is that of Paul. He himself, when he writes about it, is a Christian. We cannot be sure when he had the experience. Was it perhaps after conversion? We cannot be sure how he had this experience. Could it have been a vision or a dream? Visions and dreams were widely believed at that time, and of course are mentioned in the New Testament itself. Other claims to have experienced the risen Jesus are only secondhand at best, and often clearly much further removed. Point three, the only other potential evidence, the testimony of the empty tomb, is first found in later sources, decades after the event, and with many legendary elements. Four, it is clear that there are significant gaps in our data. An important one of these is the missing hostile tradition. Professor Montgomery mentioned about the hostile accounts of Joseph Smith. This was my point. Yes, it is true that Charles Anthon claims that he did not verify the translation of the Book of Mormon. This is quite correct, though in two letters that he wrote, he apparently contradicted himself. I haven't seen these myself. The farmer who took them, Martin Harris, who took the material to him, though, came back convinced that they had been authenticated. We have two irreconcilable stories. But the point is, we do have the second story. We do have Anthon's denial. We do not have this with the case of the resurrection. We don't have the hostile tradition. We don't have the other side. We don't have the Roman who says, yes, they stole the body away, if there was such a story. The point is, we have this gap in our evidence, and this means that we only have the believing side. We do have some hints in the Gospels that there was a hostile tradition, but we don't have any real concrete evidence. Until we see the other evidence, it's difficult to judge what the accounts were. And my point five, I think, is perhaps already clear, but I'll make it anyway. Why is it that we're debating this question? Is it because it is simply an interesting or even important historical question? Well, no, we're debating this issue because it is a religious question. Ultimately, those arguing for the resurrection are not arguing for historical evidence in most cases, but for religious belief. That is, the belief came first, and then the historical investigation has come second in most cases. And I think this is demonstrated by the evidence, by the reaction when someone presents evidence from another religious tradition. Suddenly, people who are quite willing to accept at face value the Gospels and so on, immediately reject and point out how unreliable the evidence is in another religious tradition. And suddenly they become skeptical scholars, just like some of us are about the New Testament. And all of the historical rationalization becomes forgotten. The debate we are having arises only in a Christian context with Christian concerns. Why aren't we debating the historicity of Muhammad's ascent to heaven? Or why are we debating the resurrection stories in rabbinic literature? This is another religious tradition. Why aren't we debating those? Why aren't ancient historians who are Muslims or Jews or atheists setting up conferences on the historicity of the resurrection? If the matter was a clear-cut historical issue, we would expect no less. Ancient historians do not see the resurrection as a historical fact to be entered into their histories, any more than American historians use the Book of Mormon to write about pre-Columbian history. If you wish to believe in the resurrection, of course, you're welcome to do so as a matter of religious faith. If you do so, though, I say it's not because of the historical evidence.
Say that you are not a historian or a student of history. Let's say you're not a student of Professor Graeber. Let's say you might never want to study with me. Perhaps you're in the health sciences or astronomy. How can you come to any kind of decision yourself about a matter of this sort? I'm going to try to help you do that in the few minutes that I have at the very end of the session. First, I think we can take care of a few matters and get them out of the way, and then we can look for some principles that may help. First, Professor Graeber says you've got to be able to rule out all other explanations. It's got to be done in that absolute way. May I point out that we're dealing with a question of empirical fact, a question of history. It is impossible ever to have evidence rise to a 100% level where any fact is concerned. The only way you can get absolute results is by feeding them in through absolute presuppositions. That's why formal logic or mathematics, as Russell and Whitehead pointed out in the Principia, can be said to be absolute. They're absolute in the sense that if you grant the presuppositions, then of course you get the results. That's why you felt so good writing QED at the end of your geometry proofs. But history doesn't work that way. Ordinary experience involves weighing evidence. That's why in the courts there is no standard of proof of 100% absolute certainty. In criminal trials, it's to a moral certainty, which simply means beyond a reasonable doubt, not beyond all doubt. I'm not trying to tell you that the evidence here is beyond all doubt. What I'm trying to tell you is that the evidence is so good that in ordinary affairs, you wouldn't hesitate a moment to go on the basis of it. But that's the only basis that we have for determining anything in our experience. I mean, is Professor Graeber serious about archaeological evidence? If someone rises from the dead and then ascends into heaven, what is supposed to be left there as an artifact? Jesus didn't write anything. That's correct. Neither did Charlemagne. Neither did Charlemagne. All we have is Einhard's biography of Charlemagne. Do historians therefore go around saying, well, we really can't say anything about Charlemagne. All we can talk about is what Einhard said about Charlemagne. And so on through so much of the history that we have contact with. The fact that someone doesn't write anything is not crucial. What is crucial is that we have records by reliable witnesses who tell us about that person. It is very seldom in the courts of our land that we expect people to have done their autobiography before we listen to any testimony concerning them. Dreams were indeed present at that time. Dreams are present today. Isn't that so? But do we, in handling historical narratives, ask ourselves, well, if some people have been using dreams, then I guess we can look at it that way. For example, let's say that we're studying the great exposition, you know, Prince Albert's great exposition in the middle of the 19th century here in England, and we come across Charles Dodson's Alice in Wonderland, and there we have this mystical dream-like story, and we say, ah, notice the kind of literature that existed in the middle of the 19th century. Undoubtedly, the descriptions of the Great Exposition are really not historical. They're dreamlike. You can't do that. That is a post hoc, propter hoc kind of reasoning. What you've got to do is to start with a particular document and ask what that document is intending to do. You can't use other documents to try and force the document into a literary category. Well, this sort of thing we can see quite clearly. But what do we do if we're not historians or philosophers, if we're not in a position really to evaluate, for example, the statements that I have made or the statements that Professor Graeber has made in regard to these New Testament documents? Let me make three suggestions. First, You forget Graba and you forget Montgomery. You forget Graba, you forget Montgomery. You read the stuff. Why not read the stuff? Presumably, we both agree that these materials are primary in the sense that they are the primary subject of our discussion this evening. Why don't you read the stuff and see if it rings true? J.B. Phillips, who translated the New Testament, really paraphrased the New Testament, did a book entitled The Ring of Truth, and in it he talked about his translating. He said, when I translated the New Testament, it was like wiring a house without turning the mains off. It was like wiring a house without turning the mains off. In other words, the stuff grabbed him. There was something about that material that rang true. That you can test out for yourself. Second, if in doubt, give the benefit of the doubt to the text. That, unfortunately, is not what Professor Graba does all the time. He's often fairer to Josephus than he is to the New Testament. I have a number of examples. I worked through his two volumes. I have a number of examples where he simply writes off certain New Testament items, and especially in the book of Acts, even though there is good argument that can be provided in behalf of the material. Give the text the benefit of the doubt. Why? Why? Because that's what we have to do when we work with any material. Aristotle, in doing the Poetics, was disturbed by the way people would find contradictions in Homer's Iliad and Odyssey when really the stuff was reconcilable. And Aristotle sets forth this basic principle of literary criticism that you give the benefit of the doubt to the text, you don't arrogate it to yourself as the interpreter. And of course, our courts operate on that principle. People are innocent until proven guilty. Documents are innocent until proven guilty. The burden of proof rests on the side of the person who wants to disprove this stuff, not the other way around. And thirdly, test it personally. Test it personally. Listen to what J.R.R. Tolkien said. This is Tolkien of The Lord of the Rings. He says this in an essay on fairy stories, in Essays Presented to Charles Williams, and there he's comparing fairy stories of the kind that he himself created in The Lord of the Rings with the gospel story, right? He says, there is no tale ever told that men would rather find was true, and none which so many skeptical men have accepted as true on its own merits. There is no tale ever told that men would rather find was true, and none which so many skeptical men have accepted as true on its own merits. The fact of the matter is that Jesus says that eternal life is actually available by coming into a personal relationship with him. That's what these texts set forth. Why don't you try it? See what happens. He says, if I live, you live also. Now, this kind of thing has been tried across the centuries. Augustine, Aquinas, Luther, John Milton, Dr. Johnson, Wesley, John Henry Cardinal Newman, in our own time, C.S. Lewis, T.S. Eliot, John Betjeman. If you consider... How much time have I got?
You know, very good.
It'll be short on agnostics, yes. Yes. Jean-Paul Sartre said, in following the contemporary existential tradition, all life is decision. You can't avoid making decisions. The agnostic makes a decision not to decide. It is vital that we look at this evidence and see if it warrants not making a decision at all. Surely it doesn't. This is the kind of evidence on which a decision ought to be made. Pascal said this in his Pensée. There's enough light for those who want to see, and there's also enough darkness for those with a contrary disposition. The evidence isn't 100%, but it's strong enough that it deserves your decision. And I end, since this is an English context, with the venerable Bede, the English historian of the medieval period. Bede describes the conversion of a tribe here in England. He says that the king, this was Northumbria, the king had a Christian come in and present the case for Christianity, and he had the pagan tribal leader come and give the case for paganism. And this is what the Christian said. O king, this present life of man, of man on earth, in comparison with a time unknown to us, seems to me as if you were sitting at a banquet with your thanes in the wintertime, with the fire burning and the hall warmed, and outside the storms of winter rain or snow were raging, sort of like tonight, eh? And there should come a sparrow flying swiftly through the hall, coming in by one door and flying out through another. During the time it's inside, it isn't touched by the storm of winter, but that little moment of quiet having passed, it soon returns from winter back to winter again and is lost to sight. So this mortal life is like a short interval. What may have gone before or what may come after it, we do not know. Therefore, if this new teaching, Christianity, based on the resurrection of Jesus Christ, if this new teaching has brought any greater certainty, it seems fitting that it should be followed. Thank you.